Am I Cursed? Submitted by Jesse.
For this story, I need to give a quick background of where I'm from. My dad's grandfather was an indigenous who practiced black magic. My dad often told us stories of him turning into a mule after being chased by the town. We moved around quite often because of family reasons. When I was 11 years old, we moved to a small town where my dad's sister let us stay for a while. The first day of our arrival, I feared the house so much to the point where I didn't even want to leave my mother's side. My aunt told us to stay away from the attic, and that the attic door should remain locked at all times. In my mind, I knew to follow those orders. The first night was the worst. My sister and I slept in the living room, and the whole night I tossed and turned, having the feeling that I was being watched, or feeling the air heavy every time I took a deep breath. Then, it just got even worse. I would see big shadows disappear in the hallway or footsteps in the attic every time I was in the restroom alone. 3 months later, we left the house and moved to a nearby town. I was a healthy child until I moved from that house. Then I fell ill to everything. I constantly had nightmares of a shadow following me, trying to harm me. We moved again when I was 15, and the first day I stepped into my room, I heard my name being called, and all the fear and anxiety came back to me. I knew I wasn't alone. I started to dream of a shadow following me. I felt the eyes on me. One evening, I was washing the dishes alone in the kitchen. I felt like someone was behind me, breathing on my neck. I tried not paying attention to it, but curiosity made me turn, and then I heard it. I heard a loud scream of agony. It sounded like a woman's scream. It was low, but I could feel the vibration running through me, and I got chills everywhere. I ran outside of the house and stayed there until I could compose myself to go inside again. Time passed, and everything stopped again, till last year. It became probably the worst it has ever been in my life. The nightmares were of me being dragged by the shadow figure, and I wasn't able to move. I was being dragged out of my bed across our living room, and I was trying to pray as much as I could, but the shadow would laugh. These nightmares continued for days at a time, to the point where I didn't want to sleep anymore. I dreamed of my great-grandmother telling us that she had to speak to my grandmother, and I woke up and I found out she was in the hospital. I knew she wasn't going to make it. The next night I dreamed of the shadow coming to collect the soul, but it went right by me. It was my great-grandmother's. I had woken up and she had passed away. I felt depressed and broken and drained. I dreamed of it again the next night, and I was angry at this point. I kept dreaming the shadow was on top of my ceiling, trying to take me to it. It would drag me from my bed, but this time I clawed onto my bed and on the door to stay, and I prayed louder and stronger than ever. What it seemed like a loop of never-ending terror finally came to an end. The shadow shot out of my room, and I put crosses onto my door. Months later, I dreamt of the dead trying to find the light in me to escape that shadow that torments them in the afterlife. And I selfishly avoid them because a part of me is still that 11-year-old girl who first walked into that house. The reason the shadow only came in my dreams was because I lost 80% of my vision throughout the years because of the sickness. I came across a lady who said she spoke to the dead, and she said I was being followed by them because I was paying for the deed that my dad's grandfather once made.
Whoa, Jesse! I talked to Jesse today.
Yeah.
I think it's actually he submitted the story. And yeah, that's a really creepy story. I'm really sorry you're going through that.
Yeah.
Maybe you could look up some like cleansing rituals or something that will help
get rid
of that stuff. That sounds like a story that we had yesterday. We had last week about a girl who knew that her grandmother was passing. We got a lot of clairvoyant uglies in the group.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for submitting your story. And yeah, try to look into something you can do to maybe cleanse yourself.
Your bloodline.
Yeah, your bloodline. So you don't have to pay for that stuff. What you found is you found True Scary Stories with Edie. This is a podcast where two comedians read scary stories. And there will be commentary. And it will not be funny sometimes.
Well, to people that aren't ready for it to be funny.
So if you're not into comedians reading scary stories and making comments and being complete jerks sometimes. This might not be the podcast for you.
No, go to another podcast, guys. Just all right. Go.
And so this is your fault now if you continue listening past this point. Let's get into our next listener story. If you want to submit a story to us, you can do that through our Facebook group, which is facebook.com/truescarystorieswithedie. I'm getting really good at this.
Yes.
Okay, let's get to the next story. Our next story is called A Man Came Knocking, and it's submitted it to us by our ugly Rosie.
I work at a preschool, and I always listen to True Scary Stories during nap time, and I always get super paranoid and scared when Nick is reading the stories, and then I want to laugh so hard during y'all's commentary. Pretty sure my co-teachers and four-year-olds think I'm weird, but I have so many stories from Mexico that I heard growing up. Ever since I can remember, I've gone with my family every summer and winter to the state of Guanajuato, which is right smack in the middle of Mexico. Oh, Guanajuato. It's mainly known for its cajeta and mummies. Anyway, in our town, everyone has a story about the paranormal and the occult. My family is pretty sure there's a bunch of witches hanging around too. One of the crazier stories about the witches I've heard from my mom and her siblings is one that my mom always talks about when we're all gathered together. I don't know if anyone else's family does this, but it's always the same group of us that stays around and sits around the table or a bonfire after the party has died down and most of the other family members have gone home. When we're all together at that time, someone always brings up something scary that has happened to them, and then the spooky storytelling goes from there. Well, every time we do this, my mom brings up the story about the time that a man came to spend the night at her house and that they were pretty sure he was a Nahual. It was a night that it was raining pretty bad, and a man came knocking on the door. I think he was a shoemaker or a leather seller. Well, he needed a place to stay, and my pa Beto has always been a kind man and let him stay the night. The houses in Mexico where we all stay have divided parts of the houses. So my grandparents' house has a row of rooms, an open space in the middle of the property, and then another row of rooms where they let the man stay. My mom and my tia Irma are the two youngest out of 9 children in their family. So they were the only ones living with my grandparents by that time. My mom was probably about 5, and my tia was a baby. Around the middle of the night, my grandparents woke up to my tia Irma crying inconsolably. So while my grandma was trying to put my tia back to sleep, my pa Beto went outside to the room to make sure the man was okay. And when he peeked in that window, he saw the man sitting there in the middle of a circle that he'd made out of candles. When he went back to my grandma and told her what he saw, they were both so scared they didn't go back out from their side of the property. Then, my grandparents heard something land on top of one of the roofs with a huge bang. And when my grandpa looked out the window, he saw something huge fly off the roof. They think he was a Nahual because they're said to be witches and warlocks who can turn themselves into animals, mostly owls, who have always been associated with witches. My mom says that when my grandparents heard the bang on the roof, they think the guy had turned into an owl or something and left because they had seen him doing who knows what in that room. Another story about these creepy-ass witches we have is about one of my great-grandfathers. My family always talks about how witches are relatively harmless. If you encounter one, it's usually because she's fucking with you. So that's what happened to one of my great-grandpas. Back in his time, the men had to take their livestock up the mountain and usually had to camp out and spend the night alone with them up there. Well, one night, my great-grandpa was up there, and this witch started playing tricks on him, and he was starting to get pissed off. I don't really remember how, but he ends up being able to capture her, and he ties her up and starts reciting prayers to her, and all the while she's begging him to stop. Finally, he tells her to leave him alone, and that he'll leave her alone, so she promises to him that she will, and she unties her, and like any other Nahual, she shapeshifts into an animal. I want to say I remember saying she turned into a pig, and she ran off. Pretty far-fetched, I know. I don't really like to believe in these witches' stories because they just seem so crazy, but it has always been so fun listening to these stories and seeing who gets scared the most. I have other creepy stories that I could share some other time, but thanks for listening to these and taking the time to read them. Love y'all.
We love you too, and thank you for sharing that. I am the one who has been getting, who gets the most scared. If you were wondering who gets the most scared, it's me, Edie Gibson.
Now, every time I walk outside after these, I am constantly fearful of a witch standing out there.
Yeah, and we did see a witch one time.
Well, we saw, we don't know what it was.
We thought we saw a witch for sure. We came back from the beach, we were all tired. What was it? Yeah, it was the beach. We came back, we were all tired, it was at night, and there's this, we pull up to a parking space on a completely dead street, and there's this scary woman standing still right outside the passenger window.
And
her face was lit up by her phone, and it just so happened she was like one of the ugliest women I've ever seen. So it made it 20 times scarier when she just startled us. And
it scared me that witches have cell phone plans.
What kind of cell phone plans do they have? AT&T.
Okay, good. Okay, you did it.
Take that, haters. I am funny. Okay, so today's topic, and it was suggested to us by one of our uglies on the Facebook group, I think Rosie, is stories from Mexico. Arriba!
Yes, we did have an ugly suggestion. They said, I have tons of stories, and then they submitted none.
Okay.
But so luckily we found some.
Yeah, luckily we found some. And Nick is Mexican.
Yes.
But
if I say that, I'm American, Mexican, because if I say I'm Mexican, they'll be like, oh, what part of Mexico? And it's like...
And you're like...
Texas.
Okay. All right. Okay. Okay, cool. And I thought I was Mexican, but it turns out I wasn't.
No, you're Filipinos.
I grew up thinking I was Mexican when we took a DNA test, and I am Filipino, Native American, and Irish.
Which is Mexican.
Which is, yes, Spanish for Mexican. All right, well, let's get into our topic. The promise.
I've read many stories and decided to post this story. It did not happen to me, but to an uncle. This happened to my mother's older brother when they lived in Mexico, according to the eldest uncle who was telling us the story. My uncle must have been around 10 when he had an encounter with an entity. I'll give you an idea of the area they lived in. My grandparents' home was made of adobe with a small gate that surrounded it to keep small animals out. They lived in the countryside surrounded by beautiful green hills. You had to walk down a hill to take a narrow pathway. The narrow pathway looked like a labyrinth, and that's what they named it. It was made deep in the soil from frequent rainstorms. This was the only safe path to their home in town. Now to the story. I'll be calling my uncle by his name, Juan. And since I do not remember his uncle's name, I will just say his uncle's name is Uncle. Juan had an uncle he loved and admired. This uncle frequently visited the small boy and would always bring him goodies. The uncle always wore a gray, beautiful sombrero. Juan really liked the sombrero and always made sure it was placed in a clean, safe place. One day, before heading out, the uncle told Juan, "I promise the next time I visit, I will bring you one." Juan was ecstatic with the news. A few hours later, word came to Juan's father. His brother had been ambushed in the labyrinth by federales and shot to death. Juan, hearing this news, became fearful because his uncle made a promise and died before fulfilling it. One afternoon, as Juan headed home and entered the labyrinth, he began to hear footsteps behind him. He glanced back and didn't see anything, but knew someone was following him. He was scared and decided to run home. As he reached the end of the labyrinth and headed up the hill, he quickly glanced behind him and saw a shadow. He stopped running as soon as he thought he had enough distance between him and the person following him. He then looked back once more, and to his horror, he saw the outline of a man with a sombrero walking towards him. It had no features, and it was all black. Juan ran crying all the way home and would occasionally look behind him to see the shadow following him. As soon as he crossed the gate and opened the front door to the home, Juan saw his mother in the kitchen. He ran to her, crying, and told her, "Mom, something is following me. It looks like a man, and I think it's my uncle, but I cannot see what he looks like." His mother headed to the front door and looked outside. She did not see anybody and told him he probably imagined it. After a few minutes of calming down, Juan peered out the front door and saw the shadow at the entrance of the fence. He was just standing there. Juan ran to his mother, crying and screaming. His mother, irritated and upset, told him, "You tell him he does not owe you anything and to leave you alone." Reluctant, Juan headed to the front door. The shadow was standing at the gate's entrance. Juan began to scream, "Go away! You do not owe me anything! Go away! Leave me alone! You do not owe me anything! Go!" He saw the shadow turn around and head to the hill. As the shadow began to walk away, it vanished. To this day, my uncle refuses to acknowledge that this ever happened.
Tell him how you know the story.
I think his mom, the person that wrote it, their mom
So his mom could just be crazy and being like, "Oh, this whole thing happened." And he's like, "Man, that didn't happen." And then we have this story. What do you think? You think it happened?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes, because I saw Coco.
Oh, okay. And you said that was really good, so I believe you.
Yes.
That's weird that the uncle just had... I mean, I wouldn't be so scared if I was a kid, because I'd be like, "Well, it's my uncle." And I think of it more of as like a protection thing.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised the mom didn't just tell him, like, "Hey, this is your uncle, and he's just, you know, he wants to fulfill a promise to you."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I guess... I don't know. They probably hurt his feelings, man.
Yeah, they did. They definitely did.
He probably had that sombrero, the new sombrero behind his back. Dude. And he was like, "To be at peace, I just need to give you my old..."
Okay, bye.
Go away. Okay,
bye. It's just like Coco, man.
I didn't see Coco. See, this is completely lost on me.
It's Coco. Okay. That's basically the story of Coco.
That the uncle comes to give a sombrero?
No, it's the green grandpa.
You could have got a new sombrero out of it, but you were too selfish.
Yeah, you screamed at your poor dead uncle.
Yeah, he's been through enough. Near the Shed.
I grew up in a small town in Guanajuato, Mexico, with my aunts and grandma. My parents were in the U.S. trying to buy a house for me to move into. I was about 5 years old at the time. One calm evening, my aunt and I were going to go down to the town square to hang out with her friends. She instructed me to go tell my grandma that we were leaving. She told me that my grandma was in the garden. The backyard was big, and the garden was at the very back. I didn't think twice about it. I went to the back of the house and started to walk towards the garden. The sun was setting, and it was bright enough to see everything clearly. While walking, I happened to glance to my right at an old shed that we had. Next to the shed, there was a stack of ceramic roof shingles, because the house was going to have the roof refurbished. What I saw next still gives me chills today. As I looked over to the shingles, I saw a woman dressed in all black. The woman's clothes were the darkest black I had ever seen. Next to the woman was an all-black cat with bright yellow eyes looking right at me. I stopped walking and looked at the woman. I tried to look for her face but was not able to due to a hood that covered it. The only thing I could tell was that she was not sitting on a pile of shingles. She was crouching on it. The shape of her knees could be seen through the clothing. Her pale, bony hands dangled down by her feet. I was frozen in place, but for some reason I was not afraid. After a few seconds of looking at her, I remembered that I had to go tell my grandma that we were leaving. I continued to walk to the garden while periodically glancing back. I saw my grandma and told her that my aunt and I were going down to the town square. She acknowledged me, and as I jogged back to my aunt. On the way back, I looked back at the pile of shingles, thinking that I would see the lady again. Nothing. Both the woman and the cat were gone. I'm 25 years old now, and I still can't explain what that thing was on the pile of shingles. I have told one of my aunts that still lives in the house in Mexico about my experience, and she told me that many people have seen that lady and her cat around town. Everyone seems to agree that she is some kind of witch or possessed woman. I recently went back to Mexico to visit my family. Every time I walk past that old shed, I feel like someone's watching me. I don't know if I ever want to go back there again.
Yeah, just stop going back there.
Yeah.
I don't know why you want to hang out by an old shed anyways with some crouching lady.
Yeah, maybe it's your grandma's defense system. To keep her damn grandchildren from bothering her while she's in the garden.
Yeah, and keep those darn kids off of her lawn.
Yes.
And don't try to pet my cat neither.
Yes.
They had to do it.
My dad is a musician, not a famous one. He and his friends have a band that do little gigs that pop up here and there. About a year ago, the band got offered to perform on a week-long cruise headed for Costa Maya and Cozumel for $1,000 each. Unfortunately, the time of the cruise had coincided with a Thursday, which meant a school day for me, and my mom had a trial to play defense for. So to our great disappointment, what followed that day of my father splitting for a paid vacation was a week consisting of photos sent by text message that made both me and my mother quite envious. I mean, he got to sip on tequila and play music at poolside while I fought to survive my senior year and my mother for her client's innocence. However, there were some photos that brought a smile of hilarity to our faces, such as a lonely chicken that my father found just wandering the streets of Cozumel. So to put it bluntly, our envy became that of jokes upon his return that following Friday. Almost as soon as he had walked through the door, my dad was spinning stories worthy of being put into a written biography. He told of how the massive Aztecan structures we'd been shown had played host to the likes of human sacrifices and bloodletting in ages past, then followed by stating how two cities played host to their own playing of music by lesser knowns on a street corner after dark. I'd always had a keen interest in the supernatural, especially when it comes to the subject in which my father discussed. Despite my Christian beliefs, the idea of such entities of myth invoking such taboo and violent behavior has never ceased to astound me. I just have so many questions as to why one could fear their own theories about existence so much that they would so willingly tear the heart from their own brother to appease such phobias. I just don't understand why they felt they needed to do it. I assume it was for this reason that my dad brought back the skull. It was just before dinner when my dad called me into the kitchen for me to obtain it. When I then entered, he was holding it up like a somewhat Shakespearean style, examining it for any scratch or bump it may have received on the long journey home. He handed the skull to me and told me of its brief backstory. "How do you like it, Carl? Found it sitting on the table in one of those old temples. Thought you might be interested." I didn't answer. I didn't want to give my honest opinion, as truth be told, despite my interest in such weird and disturbing subjects, I found the thing to be quite unsettling. Let me first make clear that it was not real. It was actually made of ceramic. It was a work of art, carefully crafted by an unknown sculptor of ages past. I could make out the hieroglyphs of starfish and leaves, as well as many other inconceivable shapes. But the unnatural roundness and images of apparent beauty were not enough to hide the uncanny nature of its face. The skull's eyes were both bordered in a deep shade of black, and the color streamed far down the sides of its face in four long lines of tears on either side. The mouth itself was quite pale, but consisted of these non-decaying human lips. The smile that these lips gave off? A wide, black-lined grin. I could feel the stiffening of hairs along my back as I begrudgingly took the thing up to my room after dinner. I settled for the shelf that sat just above my desk, and I set the skull down on its very end. I decided to go to bed early, so I locked my door, got dressed, then climbed in bed. Just as I was about to shut the light, though, I climbed back out. I approached the shelf, and then proceeded to turn the skull to face the wall. "Better," I whispered. I wouldn't let that stare gaze upon me as I slept. The next morning, I woke to much in the way of discomfort. Do you know that pain in your head, that of which a bad night's sleep so generously provides? Well, I could feel it, and I could feel it hard. It was almost at migraine level. Thankfully, I could slowly begin to smell the very best thing that one could awake to on a Saturday morning. I made my way to the stairs, ready for such a great breakfast, and noticed the skull's glare out of my eyes as soon as I left the room. When the near migraine ceased, the day went by as normal as any other Saturday would. I had breakfast, watched YouTube on my phone for a good hour, then played video games in my room for well into the night. Yes, as you may be able to tell from my routine, I am not a very social child. I would even go as far to say I am friendless, or even a goth with what creepy things I find interest in. It was about 10 after 11 when I finally decided to shut off the light for some well-needed comfortable sleep. I locked my door and climbed into bed, but just lay there in silence. I was uncomfortable, suspicious even. I climbed out of bed once more and walked over to the skull on my shelf, which now appeared as even more awful in the dark. The designs almost appeared as one deep shaded color, and its shape seemed slightly off based on the shadows. The only apparent good thing was the fact that I could not make out the wide black lined smile from previous telling. I got a burning sense of deja vu as I then proceeded to turn the skull around and climb back into bed for a good night's rest. I did not rest comfortably. Walking down the stairs with the same apparent headache from the previous morning was only the least of my worries on this particular Sunday. I walked groggily into the kitchen, and as I poured out some cereal, I could feel eyes at the back of my head. I turned my head to see my parents' stares from the kitchen table, both of which were formed into mild glares of disapproval. "What?" I asked them while yawning. "What's the problem?" My dad let out a brief sigh as he responded to me. "We know you were up late last night." I was confused. "What do you mean, Dad? You let me stay up all the time at 11. Why is this suddenly a problem?" "Okay, now don't lie. You were up till 3. We could see it." "See it? Your light," my mom responded. "We could see it from underneath your door. Are we not right?" I was bewildered, speechless at what they inquired. I know very well from the memory that my phone said 11 before passing out yesterday evening. "Yep, still on at least until after 3 or a bit later, give or take," my dad continued. "Either way, Carl, why were you even up that late to begin with?" Still, did I fail to supply them with a response? The headache was now long faded, and even though I could not think clearly enough to produce any words, I stuttered out. My parents just rolled their eyes and seemed to smile a bit. "Look, it's no reason to be nervous," my dad informed. "You at your age, you just need more sleep, all right? At least 8 hours is enough, not 4. Still no words. "We're going to just get ready for church," my mom said as we both left the room. "We love you, son. Don't tire yourself out." I heard them both stomp up the stairs as I just sat there alone with my thoughts, that of which were now scrambled and unfocused. It was when their door finally shut that I snapped back to normal focus and happened to notice their phones left sitting on the kitchen table. I checked the clocks on both, which shared exactly the same time, 8:30, and then I checked my phone, 8:30. My state of bewilderment had now been worsened. I scarfed down my breakfast, and as I finished, I then heard my mom and dad come strolling back down, both now fully prepared for Mass. I rushed upstairs to get dressed. Upon entering my room, I noticed it, the skull. It was facing my bed once more, still smiling that same smile. At first sight of it, I assumed it was my parents who may have laid their hands on it. Then, we locked eyes. Its eyes. There was something presiding from deep within them. I was in too much in a panic to fall asleep that night. I was even too horror-struck to enter my room, as I assumed it now had been cursed by that demonic corpse's head. Now, at this point, I would assume you'd be asking questions somewhere along the lines of, "Why don't you just dispose of the skull?" Well, I'd rather ask you this. If you were almost certain that one of the belongings in your room was haunted, and knew what I did about spirits and demons from religion, then would you even have the slightest bit of courage to lay another hand on it? At this point, I was hoping at best to convince my parents to let me sleep on the couch that evening. It took some effort, but they reluctantly submitted to it. This could not have been more of a blessing to me, as things became much more sinister once I went to brush my teeth in the upstairs bathroom. As I stared into the mirror, I could make out something from the reflection of the hall outside the open door. It was unclear at first, but I could now make out from under the crack of my bedroom door a glow. It almost seemed to resemble my own lamp when it switched on, but then I saw the glow pulse. It continued to do so in patterns, and I was already halfway down the stairs before it could continue. My parents were already in their respective spots in bed, but they did not fail to supply me with both a blanket and pillow on the couch. I set up both items on the sofa and turned off the light on the end table. I threw the blanket over myself and I just lay there. That was it. Lay there. Even with the distance I had put between myself and the skull, I didn't even have the slightest morsel of courage to shut my eyes. They fought my fears, however. They got progressively heavier and heavier with each passing minute. About 10 minutes in, my head fell to the side. I shot my eyes back open in the following second. Had it been a second? I thought to myself. I went to reach for my phone sitting on the coffee table, but I instead was hit with a harsh reality. My arm wouldn't move. My legs would not budge either, nor my head. I was overcome with terror as I now realized that my body was experiencing sleep paralysis. The only sign of fright I could muster was the mad darting of my eyes as I searched the room with overwhelming anticipation. I knew what horror was to follow, but was not truly prepared for it in the least. My eyes panned the room in a desperate search for any sort of black spot, any shadow, or other discoloration within the room, or even in the hallway that opened up next to the entertainment center. In my half-awoken state, I was struggling to see anything clearly. It was all just a blur. It took about a minute or so, but then I noticed something. Atop the entertainment center sat a discoloration, a smidgen of white. I could not make out any other features, but that was only due to the blur of my vision. However, my attention to this object was broken as my ears then picked up on something else, a whisper. It came from my right. I threw my sight in that direction and happened upon yet another object, a shadow, a humanoid shadow. It was standing out in the hall, staring directly at me. Was it an intruder? Was my first thought. I assumed it might have been, as they appeared to be wearing a mask. All that was visible of their face was a deep shade of red, whilst the rest of the figure was completely shrouded in the blackness of the night. It was motionless, not stirring even an inch. From it had obviously emanated the whisper, which I could still faintly hear. It sounded as if it whispered a single phrase, but what? I could not tell. It just stared blankly in my direction, and I stared directly back. This went on for what seemed like more than 10 minutes, and all the while I felt as though my heart might stop from how hard and fast it was beating. The dark figure still maintained its glare on me as I could feel my muscles begin to slightly twitch. My legs sparked to life and began kicking sporadically, and my arms were then able to throw the blanket from my body. I then blinked. Nothing. Both objects of black and white had now dissipated. My heart began to slow back to its original pace as a wave of relaxation washed over me. It was truly just a hallucination. I wiped the sweat from my head with the back of my now mobile arm. Even with how calm I felt, my mouth was so dry and my body was drenched. I probably needed a shower in the morning, but all that I needed now was a glass of water. I turned my whole body to get ready to stand up and head for the kitchen. Suddenly, I felt a tremendous amount of pressure as though I was being held down. My body pressed hard into the sofa as I stared in horror up at the ceiling. It was now right above me. I could make it out more clearly, and it was enough to understand what monstrous being I now beheld. What I had once believed to be shadows was actually a long, black hooded cloak. It ran all the way down to the very bottom of the entity, where it then split off into multiple torn strands. But without these strands, there appeared to be no true bottom to the entity at all. It was spectral, having no true physical form. Nevertheless, this did not distract me from my recognition of the dark figure's most blood-curdling feature, its mask-like face. Not a mask, its true face. The face certainly was one of deep shade of red, but that same could not be said for its other features. The eyes on the thing were as massive as black as the darkest recesses of space, almost appearing as though completely empty. In spite of their lifelessness, though, the eyes appeared to be weeping. The tears had color to them as well, the color of dripping ink. They ran in streams that dripped down the monster's cheek and onto its cloak, becoming one with its very color. The emotion this thing inhibited, the expression that it wore, a large, wide black lined grin. What I had once feared happening before had now finally come to pass. My heart had exhausted itself. My chest became immobile as my lungs struggled desperately to take in oxygen. It almost felt as though this thing was somehow crushing every organ in my body, prohibiting me from ever taking another breath or even speaking. I tried to scream, but not even a choke could escape from me. That horrific smile. It was a smile of joy. Joy at the sight of my suffering. Do. The whisper. It had returned. I can make it out more clearly now. It. It seemed to pass through my mind rather than through its lips and into my ears. Do it. The images followed. Those images. Do it. My parents. Do it. In bed. Do it. The blood. Do it. I stood over. Do it. The knife in my left. Do it. Two red objects in my right. Do it. My smile. My eyes. Do it. Black. Do it. I was fading fast. Soon would I be imprisoned, condemned, free for the taking by this ferocious incubus. There was no person, no other entity here to fend off this living nightmare. It was pure evil. Evil. Do it. Our Father, I strained out, who art in heaven, hallowed be. The whisper was fading. The expression, it was now a grimace, but deliver us from evil, I finished. It was fading, fading fast. The pressure was now leaving me. In but the briefest of seconds did the nightmare become one of, with my memory. It had now vanished again into the metaphysical, but what had brought it into this realm in the first place was far from known to me. Then I sat up. The smidgen of white, the glow, it sat upon the coffee table now. I switched on the lamp behind me to better understand what I was really looking at. Once the lamplight began flooding the room, the glow then quickly dimmed. The skull. No, not the same one. This one was real. The proportions, the texture, the color, it was all real. There was blood on this decrepit thing. Blood. Large stains of it that covered the entire cranium and the jawline. His jaw was sitting wide open, almost appearing as though it was screaming in terror. If I knew any better, I'd say it was one part of multiple remains of a murder victim, an unwilling participant of human sacrifice. It was changing now. The blood stains on it were cracking, shrinking. Then they rose off and dissipated into the surrounding air, revealing starfish and other incomprehensible shapes. The paleness of the base of its eyes were darkening now, and so were the teeth as the jaw continued to cement shut. That decayed jaw began to grow back its lips as well, and those very same lips began to curl into that horrible smile, that grin. I got up well before my parents that morning. Hold on, let me reword that. I mean to say that I never even got up at all. I mean, how could I wake up if I never even fell back asleep again? I just couldn't. I couldn't risk it with that insidious force. It might be attempting another shot at me. I made sure to let my parents know that I'd be leaving early for school. I claimed to them that I would be studying with some friends. Instead, I went out to a nearby river to throw that damn skull into it. Instantly, I felt warmth. But I was left with this thought. Human sacrifices may have been necessary. Our ancient ancestors were not theorists. They were prisoners. To the evil demanding this sacrifice, they had to do it.
Well, it's so freaky.
I know.
And you know, the dad was like, where is the skull I got you?
Yeah. The stupid dad took it from a temple, man.
That's really stupid. Well, yeah, dad. Well, they said he was just drinking. He sounds like a kind of cool dad. He was just drinking and finding chickens.
Well, it's always tourists that steal stuff from places that they shouldn't.
He was a professional. He was playing on a cruise.
No, he wasn't a professional.
Hey, who booked your dad?
Yeah, let us know.
Yeah, we want to go. We want to work on a cruise.
Did you hear that noise from the kitchen?
Yeah. Oh, I forgot about that. Oh, yeah, there was a really scary noise in the kitchen. It was like a growling. I think it was just
it's the sink.
The garbage disposal going, but it was like, right in Nick, I'm going to kill you. it was really freaky.
It said, yeah, I like that you're reading my story.
Do it. Yeah. Yeah, but now someone's going to find the skull and be like, yeah, this is pretty fucking cool. Or they're going to call the police and be like, hey, I just found a skull.
Yeah.
And then the police are going to have it in their evidence lockup. And then one of the police is going to go to get something and it's going to be like, dude, no, you're freaking me out the way you were saying that. Do it, do it, do it. You're freaking me out with that. Do it. And then some police officer is going to kill another police officer. It's going to be a whole thing. And then that police officer is going to be in jail and be like, this girl told me to do it.
Do it.
Okay, next. Gone Hunting.
As a young kid living in a small town in Mexico, I heard many tales and stories about ghosts, spirits, witches, and even the devil. I never believed in that stuff back then. Now that I'm older and reflect on some of the things that I experienced, I am positive that evil does exist. When I was young, I lived in a small town of Borullo. The town is located in the state of Guanajuato. The town has now become more modern with paved roads and cars, but when I lived there, everything was much simpler. The interesting thing about this town is that it is located between tall hills. During the summer, when the vegetation grew at its fullest, the hills would turn into dense forests. The vegetation was also so dense that only the most experienced hunters would go out in groups to try and catch animals. I always wanted to go into the forest with the others. I wanted to learn how to shoot and hunt too. I would always bother my older cousin Jose, who was one of the guys who had went out regularly and spent days tracking animals and hunting them. Finally, one day, my cousin agreed to take me with him and his friends. I knew most of the other guys and was ecstatic about finally going hunting. There were a total of 7 guys going, including myself. Jose told me that I had to listen to him no matter what. He told me that it could get dangerous, and he had to take care of me. Me, being super excited, agreed to whatever he said without giving it any thought. We were leaving the next evening. I was so excited that I barely slept that night. The next day, Jose helped me pack all the essentials into a backpack that he had. We headed to the edge of town, where the forest began. Most of the guys were already there waiting. Everyone had their rifles and were fully prepared. The weather was not really cooperating. The sun was nowhere to be found as it was covered by dense rain clouds. I wasn't worried though. We all had rain gear on and were ready to go. As the last guy joined us, we all started moving into the forest. As we walked further into it, it began to drizzle. The raindrops could be heard hitting the leaves on the shrubs around us. Everyone was quiet. The only other noise that could be heard was the wet ground that we had stepped on. We walked for what seemed like an eternity. We followed a path that had been made by others walking through it, but the further we went, the narrower the path got. By this time, 4 of the guys had caught some animals. A few rabbits and squirrels were their catch. The 4 guys had turned around and walked back to town. They were happy with their kills and wanted to get out of the rain. This meant that there was only 1 other guy, my cousin, and I. Jose and the other guy were super competitive, but didn't want to stop going forward yet, so we continued. The little daylight that could be seen before was now gone. It was pitch dark. Not even the moon could shine through the clouds at this point. The only lights that we had were reflectores, flashlights that we wore on our head. The battery pack was strapped to the belt around our waist. At this point, I was starting to get a little freaked out. The rain was now coming down harder, and the path was very narrow. Jose walked in front of me with his rifle over his shoulder and a machete in his hand. He would use it to cut through any brush that was in his way. Behind me was the other guy. He carried his rifle in his hands and he kept swiveling his head left and right while scanning for animals. After a while, the rain slowed down to a drizzle again. Everything became quiet, even quieter. It was an eerie silence. There was no wind, no crickets, no birds, nothing. Jose, I called out. I want to go back. Something didn't feel right. It felt like the temperature had dropped. Every time I took a breath, I could see it in the beam of my flashlight. We can't go back yet. Someone asked me to bring them back a rabbit, Jose answered. At this point, I understood that they didn't do this for fun. They did this as a job. People from the town would ask them to go hunt them a rabbit or a squirrel to make food with it. I didn't ask again, and we kept walking. While walking in complete silence, we heard a noise. It sounded like a twig breaking. Everyone turned towards the noise. Jose put down the machete and grabbed his rifle. The guy behind me did the same. We stood there frozen, waiting for an animal to come in the light of our flashlights. I was excited to finally catch something and go home. As we scanned around, we heard another noise. A noise that sounded like a baby whining and crying. I was surprised to hear it, but I wasn't scared. I didn't know what to think. I looked over at my cousin, hoping to get some instructions on what to do. He was frozen in place, with his eyes wide. He looked at the other guy. The other guy had the same expression as he stared back. Es una pinche bruja con un niño, güey, the other guy whispered to Jose. He was implying that what we were hearing was a witch and a baby that she had taken. I immediately started to panic. As I looked up at them, I heard the baby's cry change. The high-pitched cry turned into a deeper voice. I could still hear it in my head as clearly as I heard it then. I was paralyzed with fear. I started shivering uncontrollably. I fully expected to see some demonic figure staring back at me. Before I could say anything to Jose, he grabbed me by my waist and put me over his shoulder. The other guy grabbed the machete and started running back through the path. I could tell that they were both just as scared as I was. As I bounced back up and down on Jose's shoulder, I looked behind us. I scanned the path for what now sounded like growling that continued to follow us. My cousin kept telling me to close my eyes, but I didn't listen. I kept looking back. Both of the guys were now running as fast as they could, jumping over small logs on the way down. Jose was following behind because of the extra weight that I added. He came up to another log on the path. He did his best to jump over it, but clipped his back foot on it. He tried his hardest to keep his balance as he stumbled. In doing so, he accidentally pulled the cord out of my battery. The flashlight on my head immediately turned off as I looked back. As my eyes adjusted to the darkness, I saw something on the path. I was not able to see the details very well, but I could see what looked like a deformed dog. The skin was pale. This is the only reason I was able to see it in the dark. I knew it wasn't a dog, though. There was no fur, only skin. The only other thing I can compare it to was a very skinny, elongated human. Jose, I see it, I yelled as I reached down to reconnect my flashlight. Jose didn't say anything, he just kept running. I finally managed to feel around and reconnect the flashlight. The beam of light flooded the path behind us. As the light hit that thing that was following us, I saw how bony and pale it was. It ran hunched forward, but on two legs. There was black hair on the top of its head that covered its face. I don't know it then, but now I remember seeing this thing having sagging breasts like an old woman. As I continued to look at it, I started to cry because of the fear. I knew that this thing was going to catch up to us and kill us. As I cried on Jose's shoulder, I heard a loud gunshot. It was the guy that was with us. He had made it far enough down the path that he was able to turn around and aim at the thing that was chasing us. As the shot rang through the trees, I heard the scream of a woman. I immediately looked back at the path. I saw that the thing stopped, hunched over in pain. We all looked as it continued to scream. The scream sounded like a combination of pigs wailing and a woman screaming. Jose put me on the ground and grabbed his rifle from his shoulder. He lifted the rifle and aimed at the screaming witch. Before he was able to get a shot off, the witch jumped off the trail and into the thick bushes. The screaming continued, but it got farther and farther away. Jose immediately grabbed me as they both ran down the path. I buried my head in my hands in fear of seeing that thing again. After running for what seemed like forever, we arrived at the edge of the town. Jose put me down as he struggled to catch his breath. No le digas a nadie. Don't tell anyone, he said. The other guy began walking back towards where he lived. I kept my word to my cousin and did not tell anyone, not even my family. I feel like there's a bond between me and my cousin because of that night. He and the guys continued to go hunting after that. I never asked to go on another trip again. About a month later, I heard a story about some guy from the next town over who almost got killed while hunting. He had separated himself from the group and was lost. The rest of the group started looking for him. He was found passed out on the ground with a bunch of black hair clenched in his fists. He had really deep scratches all over his face and arms. The story goes that he caught the wounded witch by the hair, but she was able to get away by attacking him.
Damn, she's got a really low success rate.
Yep.
We gotta rethink your attack here, lady.
Yeah.
Sounds like she's pretty old. And why'd you guys say that about her boobs? Maybe that's why she's not happy. Like, oh man, everyone wants to talk shit about my boobs and my bad hair and say I sound like a pig.
But that's when he noticed that it was a woman.
This is toxic masculinity, I think.
Yeah.
You know what?
It is Latino culture.
I'm on this girl's side, okay? Just because her boobs are sagging and she's chasing you.
Oh, she's like, I want
you
man.
Guys think you can talk smack about her, but it's not okay anymore.
You think it was just a single old lady out there like, I want a man.
Well, did they say her boobs were sagging first and then maybe she was chasing? You know? Yeah. Like, oh man, we saw this ugly ass girl, her boobs were sagging, and she was like, swinging back and forth, hair all a mess.
Yeah, nobody wants to see that running at you.
Sounds like PMS to me.
Yep.
Sorry, I make myself laugh too much. Okay, and then we got a multiple part story coming up, so let's get into it. I Can't Sleep Anymore, Part 1.
Since joining the Border Patrol, I've been having nightmares. This seemed like the only place I could talk about it. In the last one, I'm tracking somebody through the desert on a moonless night. My flashlight chases two pairs of footprints until I get to a clearing. Then the tracks end in the middle of the dirt. It doesn't make sense, but maybe the wind blew them away? Or they were abducted by aliens? Or maybe it's an ambush? Unsettled, I start to head back, fast. But then I trip on something in the dark dirt. My head hits the ground and my flashlight flies into the brush away from me. As I try to get up, there's this resistance on my neck. I strain to lift my head and the resistance becomes a force, a pull. Finally, I turn to see an ashy hand tugging at my collar and it wants me to join it in the dirt. That's when I wake up and I see it's just Steve pulling at my collar. Steve's my journeyman. We're at a port of entry on the U.S.-Mexico border watching their live feeds all night. I must have fallen asleep. Look alive, Dom. We got bogeys. He points at a drone video feed, and I see a man, a woman, and a child at the fence. The man cuts a hole in it while the woman watches. The kid just sort of stares into the blackness. As I try to figure him out, he turns to the camera. Maybe it's because of the nightmare, but his blank face, quivering with black and white pixels, looks like a nest of worms to me. We hit the road, tracking the sensor hits to our bogeys. Steve's been pissed at me ever since I put in my transfer to the asylum office, and the chief gave us midnights as punishment. Finally, he breaks the silence. You know, you do a lot more good out here than sitting at the desk, he says. I know, man, I know. So why quit? He asks, and now it's my turn to be mum. I'm not going to tell him about the nightmares and the guilt. When I told you that I worked for Border Patrol, you probably imagined I was some racist white guy with a mustache. Actually, I'm Latino, so the guilt is 10 times worse. Is this about the guy we found? He presses. The guy is a migrant who ran out of water and drank his own piss for 5 days until his kidneys gave out. Nah, man, it's not that. I got a girl up in Tucson, and I want to be closer to her. I lie. Should have known, he smirks. You're a pussy for pussy. He swerves off the road onto the dirt. We're headed straight for the border now, when the sensor hit stops moving. I rub my eyes and make sure it really isn't moving. Midnights haven't been kind to me. My nightmares seem to blend into reality. We track it to a spot 2 miles from the border. There's a body there, collapsed in the dirt. Steve and I bolt out of our car. Flipping the body, it looks like the guy has been mauled by an animal. Deep gashes run down his face and chest, spilling sticky and glistening black blood onto the ground. A bloody hunting knife rests in the dirt beside him that he probably used to defend himself. Mountain lion? I ask Steve. Steve shines his light on the man's face, punctured with deep and violent stabs. Something bigger than that, he says. Steve traces a path with his torch up from the body to find 2 pairs of footprints running into the brush. A nauseating deja vu bubbles up inside of me. It looks exactly like my nightmare. Steve tries a radio, but all he gets is static. Let's hang back and call the cavalry, he says. There could be people hurt up there, I shoot back. I don't wait for his response. I have enough corpses on my conscience, so I draw my weapon and head into the brush. Steve follows behind me. It's in there, where I can't see more than a few feet ahead of me, that I feel what it's like to be hunted. Not by an animal, but by something worse. Something that puts my hair on edge. It's just karma, I think to myself, and the feeling passes as we emerge. Our flashlights chase up the footprints to converge on 2 figures huddled under a Palo Verde tree. It's a mother clutching her injured kid. I put my gun away, and thankfully, they don't run as we approach. The kid looks in bad shape. His shirt is covered in blood, and he has a glassy deadness in his eyes. Does your boy need medical attention? I ask the terrified woman in Spanish. No, he's fine, just scared, she replies in English. Do you have any weapons on you? Steve barks. No, nothing, she says. Search them, he orders me. I'm going to try and call this in. He steps away. While I search and question the mom. Her name is Alma. She's from Nogales and ran away when a gang tried to kill her 11-year-old son, Juan. Examining the boy, I find the telltale bruises of gang initiation and a tattoo peeking out from his sleeve. I hike it up a little to get a better look. It's a gothic cursive M that ends in a coiled devil's tail. I've seen it many times before. It's the sign Las Maras, the ultimate bad hombres. They're the guys who tat up their entire bodies with guns and skulls and demons. No wonder the poor kid looks like he's seen the devil. It's because he has. The boy pulls away from me and hugs his mom. We want asylum, she implores me. We can talk about that back at the station, I point to the brush. Can you tell me who the dead man is over there? Here's our coyote. What happened to him? Alma clams up. Finally, she says, an animal got him. What kind of animal? Before she can answer, Steve returns with a bewildered look on his face. Dom, come listen to this. He twists the dial on his radio. It sounds like static to me, so I turn it up to the max. Just above the hiss, I can hear a man whispering. His words are lispy and don't sound like anything I've heard before, His breathless delivery sends a chill down my spine. Any idea what language that is? Pima, I offer. We're not far from the Tohon Res. Well, it's the only signal I can get out here. You mean you can't reach the station? Now my chill is cresting in a panic. No, Steve says gravely. Maybe someone's just jamming us. The cartels have gotten pretty high tech, and we're sitting ducks out here. We both look at Alma and Juan with renewed suspicion. I bind their wrists with pull-string handcuffs. Then we hike back to our car as fast as we can. The wind has picked up in a full howl, half covering the dead coyote in dirt. I help Alma and Juan into the back while Steve starts the car. What about the body? I ask. Leave it for the tribal police, he says while he struggles with the GPS on the dash. This fucking thing can't find us. Let me see. I fiddle with the settings, but all I get is a blank map and the message, GPS signal not found. The headlights of our vehicle beam pathetically into the darkness, so maybe we can see 30 feet of dirt. Without our GPS, we might as well be on the moon. Try restarting the car, I suggest. I'll try my phone. I pull up the Maps app, and I get the same message. No signal. I even stick the phone out the window, but still nothing. Nothing on my phone either. What about you? Steve bangs on the dash in frustration. Nothing. Maybe the satellite is down? GPS is a US military, so unless World War III just started, then it's not the fucking satellite. Is everything okay? Alma asks from the back. Everything's okay, I say. Then why aren't we going? We need you to be quiet, ma'am, Steve snaps. What's the problem? Are we in danger? She insists, growing anxious. We have it under control. Now I need you to calm down, Steve orders. As they argue, I try to de-escalate the situation, but Juan seems completely numb to our conversation. He just stares ahead, past us. Suddenly, his eyes go wide. He points forward and screams. I whip my head to look out the front of our vehicle. What I see is more terrifying than any of my nightmares. I will do my best to describe it. It looks like a large tumbleweed bouncing across our headlights. But it's not a tumbleweed. It's too big, too round, and too black. Even though the light hits it dead on, it's pure black. And its outline isn't a perfect circle either. It quivers, like it has hundreds of tiny hairs on it. You know in high school biology, they would show you what a virus looks like close up? That's what it looks like, except big enough to swallow you whole. At least that's what I think it looks like. I can only see it for a few seconds before it bounces into the darkness. Did you see that? I shout. See what? Steve asks me, scared. Just drive. The car lurches forward. As we barrel away, Alma clutches her son and whispers a prayer in Spanish. I check behind us, but I can't see anything other than desert. My heartbeat lowers, and I finally can think clearly. Was it all in my head? Then I remember going camping with my mom. She taught me how to navigate with the stars, and seeing the stars is one of the only things I like about this job. So we managed to follow the North Star to the road. Back at the station, I process Alma and Ham and take their fingerprints. Alma and Juan, sorry about that. The mysterious horror of the desert feels like a distant memory, washed away by the everyday horror of our bureaucracy. But I've been numb to that for a long time now. I bring Alma and Juan into Steve's office. They sit across from him, and I close the door. He takes a freshly printed document from his laser jet and starts a pitch I've heard 100 times before. I'm not sure what you've heard about our procedure, but I want to be 100% honest with you because the next decisions you will make will have a big impact on you and your family. Now, are you comfortable with English or do you want Agent Lopez to translate it? English, Alma says, and I'm relieved. I hate this next part. Excellent. This is a temporary detention facility. In a few days, you'll be transferred to another larger facility to await your trial. Your son will not be transferred with you because we are not allowed to hold him in detention. I will allow it, she interrupts. Please, let me finish everything I have to say, Steve says sharply. I will get to your choices at the end. Do you understand? Yes. As I was saying, your son will not be transferred with you. You have committed a crime against the United States, and we prosecute every case without exception. The penalties are severe if you're found guilty. You can get up to 6 months jail time, after which you and your son will be deported and barred from legally re-entering the United States. But we want to apply for asylum. Yes, you can apply, but the odds of getting it are very low. Do you remember how many people get asylum from Mexico, Agent Lopez? Between 2 and 3%. Tears start to well up in Alma's eyes. Steve's an excellent agent. He knows how to use my good cop vibe to break people. Now he goes in for the kill. But there's a way to avoid all of this, he says as he pushes forward a document with all the grace of a Vegas magician. It basically says you volunteer to leave the United States. You'll sign this, and we'll take you to a hotel tonight and put you on a plane tomorrow. You won't have anything on your record, and you can still apply for asylum legally at a port of entry. We tried in Nogales, but they sent us back. We're working through the backlog as fast as we can. It won't be any better here. She pushes the contract back. We can't go back. They will kill my son. Steve maintains his smile, but now it has a sardonic hint. You're very tired. Take a night to sleep on it, and you can tell me your final decision in the morning. He nods to me. Agent Lopez will take you to your cell. I escort them down a hallway filled with cells. They're all packed with migrants, but the last one only houses one another middle-aged woman, Maria. Even though it's 2 a.m., Maria's still up. We found her in the desert a few days ago, trying to bury her husband's body. They came all the way from Guatemala, but they couldn't keep up with their coyote. So he cut them loose. Her husband gave her the last of their water, but then she couldn't bear to leave him when he died. Now she sits on a bench and prays quietly on her rosary. I was raised Catholic. The desert convinced me there's no God out there, but I'm not so sure about the devil. I hand Alma a pair of Mylar blankets for their bedding and open the cell. Juan refuses to go in. He doesn't say anything, he just plants himself firmly into the concrete floor. Alma argues with him, then pulls him in, then pushes him in with all her might, but he doesn't budge. He just stares at Maria as she utters, El Señor es mi pastor, nada me faltará. En lugares de verdes pastos me hace descansar. And that's when Juan starts to hiss. Maria stops her prayer and turns around, white in the face. Her sudden silence soothes him, but Alma isn't relieved. Fear creeps into Alma's eyes as she escorts him inside. I help Alma make a bed for Juan, then I close the cell. On the other side of the bar, she talks to me in Spanish. Do you like what you do? Her question gets me off guard, so I answer honestly, no. Then why do you do it? Because my mom's sick. She has cancer and this is the best job for Miles. I see. Do you think I'm a monster? I blurt out. It doesn't matter, she says. I commit a crime because my son will die, and you commit a crime because your mother will die. There's no real choice when your family is in danger. I turn to leave, unable to bear any more shame in front of her, but she calls me again. But I have a choice. Should I take the deal? I freeze. This isn't in Steve's script. I already feel so much guilt for my decisions that the weight of others will crush me. Forget it. Her eyes sink to the ground and she turns to rejoin her son. I watch her crawl into her Mylar blanket and close her eyes as Maria starts to pray again. Juan lies on the ground but doesn't sleep. He just glares at Maria with a snake-like hatred in his eyes, and part of me wonders if he'll hiss again or do something worse. I get home around 4 a.m., pop some Ambien, and get into bed. It's hard to fall asleep. There's another dead body seared into my memory, this one disemboweled by a black sphere of death. But then I feel a delicious buzz flood my brain. My mind finally stops racing, and I can close my eyes. And that's when I hear it. A hiss. It's coming from under the bed. At first, I don't think it's real. I'm dreaming. And like a dream, I'm not in control of my own body. I hang my head over the bed to look underneath. Down there, something slithers in the darkness, hissing again, and it sounds just like Juan. So now I know I must be dreaming. The black quivering mass moves toward me and suddenly I'm face to face with a snake. It bares its fangs and it takes every survival instinct in my brainstem to pull me away from its bite. I watch the snake slither out from under my bed. It silently moves across the room and through the open screen door to the outside. Here's the part that terrifies me. I can't tell the difference between my nightmares and my life anymore.
Whoa, okay. That Ambien, that's why. That's why Rosie O'Donnell commented all that racist stuff.
You mean Ambien. Roseanne Barr?
Oh, Rosie O'Donnell. Yeah. Well, they're very similar when you think about it.
Well, they both had hit sitcoms, I think, in the 90s.
Yeah. Hey, sitcoms? They had hits. that wouldn't quit. Yeah. But yeah, that's what Roseanne Barr says that caused her to say some really weird stuff. I mean, Ambien has been linked to very, very crazy behavior.
Yeah, I've heard some people who could take Ambien and then their body or their mind goes asleep, but they're fully awake and they're actually having full-blown conversations.
Yeah, it makes you like super crazy. So this guy might be experiencing some kind of like weird Ambien dream. My friend Danny used to get it prescribed to him, and I took it one time, and he's like, well, you got to do is you got to stay up. So I stayed up, and we were drawing pictures, and I drew a picture of a flower, and I was like, I really don't think it worked on me. And so I was just drawing, and he was like, how can you even draw right now? And I was like, I don't know. And I was like, I don't feel it at all. And I showed him the picture. He goes, this is the greatest flower I've ever seen. And he goes, I'll never be able to draw a flower like this. Yeah. And then he started to get like really upset. Oh, I'll never be able to draw anything as good as this. I was like, wow, this is really getting to you.
Yeah.
But yeah, it didn't make me feel any kind of way.
I knew somebody who took Ambien and had a completely separate relationship that they never knew about.
They would
go visit the person on Ambien. It was a completely different...
That makes actually sense to me. I had a crush on this guy, and he took Ambien, and he kissed me, and then he texted me later, and he goes, oh, it was just the Ambien.
Oh.
And he's like, but if I take it again, I'll let you know. So anyways, it was just an Ambien kind of love.
Okay.
All right, well, let's get to the second part. Quit talking about all this weird shit. Part 2.
My next shift starts on a high note. Midnight suck all the energy and purpose out of you, but tonight I race to work because I have a radical idea how to cure my nightmares. And no, it's not Ambien or alcohol. The only way to ease my guilt is start doing things that I can be proud of. So I march straight to Alma's cell and I tell her not to take our deal. Her reaction isn't what I'm expecting. Is this another trick? She asks suspiciously. Look, a silent business isn't always impossible, as my partner made it out to be. I keep my voice down so Maria from Guatemala can't hear me. It's only 9 p.m., but she's already sleeping at the end of the cell. Next to her, Juan has crumbled up his crackers and now lines them up in pieces on the floor. They surround Maria like a border, separating her from the rest of the room. He hums some children tunes that gives me chills. I think you could have a case with Juan. He's been through a lot. But your partner said that you would separate us if we applied. That's not necessarily the case. So, there's no chance you would take away my son? His humming gets louder and louder behind her. I can't say for sure. Alma grows angry. How can you say you're the law here if you don't even know the rules? The rules change week to week, I say too loudly, and Maria stirs. Truth is, it depends on who's processing your case and who's the supervisor. I'm training to be an asylum officer, and I can tell you that there's space for interpretation. And Alma? Yes? Please don't tell anyone I spoke about this with you. As she chews over my words, a deep chuckle interrupts us from the back of the cell. It's Maria. Her body quivers as she rolls over to face us, but her head stays locked to the wall, so I can't see her face. Her arm seizes upward with its wrist bent at an unnatural angle, and poor Juan scurries back towards us. Suddenly, her giggling stops, and we all stare at her in silent terror. That's when Maria's head whips around to face us. The vessels in her eyes have burst, and she leers at us with blood-red rage. Alma screams as Maria breaks into full seizure. I struggle to get the cell door open while her legs and arms fly in every direction, scattering Juan's crackers all over the floor. Stay back, I shout as I try to keep Maria from the wall. Up close, I can see deep red lesions mark her face and arms. Her flying arms push me back, and she slips out of my arms. With a final forceful twitch, her head snaps into the wall. She's dead. I spend the rest of my shift talking to the CDC. It feels like something out of a zombie movie. Men in hazmat suits come and quarantine the cell and keep us in isolation. It's not a new feeling for me. This place is mostly a prison after all, but this time, I'm on the other side of the bars. Steve and the other agents look at me now like I'm the interloper, bringing strange disease and danger from distant shores into their lives. I sit in silence with Alma, Juan, and Maria's dead body while the CDC marks their assessment. Juan doesn't seem to be too bothered. I catch him playing with Maria's stiff fingers. He whispers to her as if she was a doll, and I swear, I see her lips twitch. Was she just settling into rigor mortis, or was she whispering back? Finally, as the sun rises, the CDC clears all of us for release. They think Maria got dengue fever from a mosquito on her way over the border, and her symptoms were interpreted as other signs of dehydration and heat stroke. Dengue is not contagious, but it's possible that she was bit by other mosquitoes in our facility that can transfer it to others. They tell us to report any signs of fever in ourselves, our co-workers, or our detainees. Then they pack up Maria's body and leave. Before I clock out, the chief calls me into his office. Steve's there, and they both still look at me like I'm not one of them anymore. "How are you feeling?" the chief asks. He's first-generation Mexican-American like my mom, in case you guys thought that only white people were the problem here. When it comes to the border, we're all complicit. Midnights have been rough. It was your decision to leave us. So what were you doing in Alma's cell last night? He asks, and I stiffen up. She wanted to talk about Maria. And you didn't talk about anything else? No. And why didn't she tell anyone on the afternoon shift? Why did she wait to tell you? I don't know, I say, and the chief raises his eyebrows incredulously. I have to give him more. It's possible she trusts me. All right, I think Agent Johnson's interrogation shook her up a little bit. That's bullshit, Steve erupts from the corner of the room. The chief raises his arm to silence Steve. It's funny you mention that because Alma informed us today that she wants to apply for asylum. She was about to sign. He must have talked to her, Steve presses. I did not. I want to think that's the case, Agent Lopez. I gave USCIS, my full recommendation for your transfer, and I hope I didn't make a mistake. You didn't. Then I need you to demonstrate that to me. I want you to conduct their asylum interview here. What? I asked, surprised. Why me? The asylum office is backed up with interviews for a month, and because of last night's excitement, ICE refuses to take Alma or Juan until they get a full CDC report. Who knows when that'll be? So it's our problem. And we just aren't equipped to keep them long term. They need to be out of here ASAP. But as long as they have a pending asylum claim, we can't deport them. He leans in and grins at me. And that's where you come in, to solve the problem. Before the interview, I try to grab a couple hours of sleep in an empty conference room. The blinds can't keep out light completely, so I struggle to fall asleep in my office chair. My eyes heavy wander around until they land in the darkness corner of the room, a place where even the intense sun can't reach me. And then there's someone in the corner staring at me. He takes a step forward from out of the blackness, and I see he's naked with dark and cracked skin like beef jerky. His eyes are clouded white, and at first I don't recognize this man, until he opens his mouth, and a water full of urine falls from it onto the carpet. Now I remember him. He drank his own urine for 5 days before we found him. A knock on the door wakes me up. The room's empty, and I spring up and open the blinds just to be sure. There's no one there, but a large wet spot stains the carpet where the man was standing. I sniff, and it smells like piss. Real strong. The knock on the door gets louder, so I don't have time to investigate. I open the door, and a junior agent enters with Alma and Juan. Do you smell anything? I ask him. Like what? I don't know, something bad. They all look at me like I'm crazy. And never mind, it's probably something from outside. You can close the door. He leaves. I set up Juan with some crayons and paper, and Alma takes a seat across from me. So you're doing our asylum application? She asks, relieved. Yes. I turn on the video camera behind me. Please be aware that this interview is being recorded. Okay, she says, struck by my sudden formality. The purpose of this interview is to establish your credible fear of persecution or torture. It is important that you tell the truth. Everything you say will be available to an immigration judge if your asylum claim goes forward. Do you understand? Yes. Okay, good. So, what do you think will happen to you if you return home? They will kill my son. Who? Las Maras. Salvatruchas. It's a bad gang. And why do they want to kill him? He was in a rival gang. Which one? I interrupt her. Los Aztecas, she answers, and I scribble down the information on my notepad. It's not starting well. To get asylum, your persecution must be based on one of five reasons: your race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or social group. Being in a gang isn't one of them. But it wasn't his choice. He was forced to join them, she adds pleadingly. Okay, I add on another note. How do you know they were going to kill him? I saw it. You were there? They kidnapped him, but I found out from a neighbor where they went, so I got a gun from a contrabandista, and we went to rescue him. Her throat stiffens as she continues. They had him tied up on the ground, and one was going to cut him open with a knife. I screamed at them to stop, and when they saw I had a gun, they let us go. I finished scribbling notes on her incredible story. Maybe too incredible. How many Maras were in there with Juan? I ask. Four. They didn't have weapons? One had a knife, the one that was going to cut Juan. So what were the other three doing? I'm not sure. Where were they in the room? On the ground. Doing what? I don't know. So this is a gang safe house, but nobody has guns, and most of the crew is taking a nap? You'll never believe me if I tell you, she shouts and breaks into tears. It's devastating to know that I brought her to this point, and I'm glad the camera can't see the guilt on my face. Behind her on the floor, Juan pauses his furious drawings and stares at his weeping mother. I push a box of tissues to her. Thank you, she manages. I know how you feel. I've seen some terrible things out there. Things that normal people wouldn't believe. But we're not normal people, are we? We're border people. We live in the space between normal. She dabs her eyes and composes herself. Then I ask again, what were the Maras doing when you found Juan? They were praying. Praying? To Satan, she says quietly, as if the words themselves were dangerous. I suddenly feel sick to the pit of my stomach. Not because I believe her, but because poor Alma just torpedoed any chance she and Juan had of staying here. I think that's all I need, Alma. You don't believe me, she says, panicked. I go to turn off the camera before she makes herself sound crazier. They were chanting in Latin. They were going to cut him open. I want to believe you, but I have to review the evidence. I open the door and tell the junior agent that he can take them back to the cell. Alma pulls Juan up, scattering his drawings on the floor. You have to believe me. We can't go back, she pleads as the agent escorts him outside. I don't have the heart to respond. I stand in the room for a while, listening to their steps disappear in the hall. Then, when the silence becomes overwhelming, I start to tidy up the room. Eventually, I pick up Juan's pictures off the ground. In the first, Juan has drawn a child in the center of a red pentagram with heavy crayon strokes. Three black blobs surround it, and another lords over it like a shadow that sharpens into a knife point. But this is the stuff you see in horror movies all the time, I tell myself. This is something Alma could have taught him to do for a gullible border agent. But for the next picture, I have no explanation. I can only describe it as the face of a yellow man who spits an arm out of his mouth and wears a crown of feathers. The drawing is crude, but not like a child would make. It's crude in an ancient way, like an Aztec painting or the wall of an Egyptian tomb. Something deep in my gut says that Juan didn't draw this. It feels older than this building, older than the border. It feels like it was always here. The sun sets outside my office, and I've officially been up for 24 hours. I try my best with this report, but there aren't too many ways to spin a satanic gang ritual into grounds for asylum. The best I can do is suggest that it could be a type of religious persecution, if it's true. There's no evidence to back up all of my stories, so I have no choice but to reject their application. Well, almost no evidence. Juan's yellow demon glares at me from their open file on my desk. His crayon skin shimmers under the fading light. I decide to sleep on the final decision, so I turn off my computer screen. There, in the blackness of the LCD, I see my own reflection. But there's something behind me. A towering yellow man with a crown of feathers that raises a scepter above my head. It is a severed arm. And I know it's really there because I can feel its fingers tickle my hair. I spin around and the room is empty. I march through the hall to the lobby, paranoid that some new nightmare will rob me of desperately needed sleep. And that's when I hear it. A scream comes from the detention beds. I freeze in place, worried that maybe no one hears it but me. To my dark relief, a junior agent runs down the hall and I follow him. Another scream pierces the air, and this one I recognize. It's Alma. We stop at her cell as she cries out for help. She cradles Juan in her arms, his skin damp and a sickly yellow color, and she calls out for help.
Oh, man! Now let's get to the last part of the story, right?
Well, this is the last part we're going to tell them this week.
Oh, because we don't have time.
Because we don't have time.
Oh, so there's going to be a cliffhanger on this one.
This is a cliffhanger. They will have to come next week to hear the rest.
What a perfect time to tell you to join the Facebook group at True Scary Stories with Edie, where you'll find the newest updates on Cruise Scary Stories
on Cruise Scary Stories.
I'm still thinking about getting on that cruise.
Damn.
So that's where you can find everything. And also give us 5 stars because it really does help us out. If you're not going to give us 5 stars because you're a hater or some kind of other thing, well then stop listening and just go away. It's a free podcast.
Or just give us 3. Don't give us 1.
No, just go away.
Okay, just go away.
Okay, and then I think that's it.
One thing I want to comment on this story is that I hope you guys do know that most Border Patrol agents are Latino, because that's where...
Are they?
Yes.
That's what I wrote down, because I was like, literally, I thought this guy was racist.
Well, he keeps saying it because I get that.
And
that
then I was like, oh, wait, no, this guy Steve is definitely racist. And then I was like, well, how old is Juan? Because they made him seem like he was way older. Oh, okay. Because, like, they're saying he was in a gang, but then he was drawing pictures. But, like, when I was 11, I don't know.
Oh, they recruit gangs, really, or gang members really young.
He was exhibiting some very young behavior.
Yeah, he's 11. My grandfather was made a soldier in the Mexican army at 12.
Right.
He fought alongside Pancho Villa. And at 12, they forced him. They said, you're either going to be in the army or you're going to die.
Okay.
So.
That's its own scary story.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's get to the last part. Please give us 5 stars, join the Facebook group. And yeah, let's do it.
And let's do the final part for this week.
Part 3.
As soon as I think I escaped midnights, they suck me back in. Alma, Juan, and I race down Route 86 in the dead of the night. It's a narrow, unlit highway through the heart of Indian country, and my high beams barely penetrate 100 feet behind me. It doesn't help that every pothole rocks my suspension like a cradle. My eyes are getting heavy and the car starts to drift to the right. Even at 100 miles per hour, my adrenaline doesn't kick in. My reserves are shot. I need to sleep. Really bad. Then my chin hits my chest and my eyes bolt open. I suddenly swerve to the car to the left and Alma shouts from the back seat. Hey, you okay? Yeah. How much further? Another half hour. It's too long. He's burning up, she yells, clutching Juan on her lap. Afraid that Juan got dengue, the brass ordered me to rush him to the nearest hospital. On the border, nearest means an hour away into Tucson. But I don't dare go faster. Drunk Indians sometimes wander onto the road at night and fall asleep. Steve hit one once, and since then we call it Death's Highway. You have to go faster, he's dying, Alma screams in my ear. Okay, okay. I hit the gas, crawling up to 110, then 115 miles an hour. The brush on either side of the road blurs into a glowing yellow lines. That's when it happens. Something black and shaggy crosses the road ahead of me. I have no time to react and hit it with full force. It must be pretty big because the impact sends it up into my windshield and over my vehicle. The sheer terror of the moment hits me and Alma at the same time. She finally screams and I have the sense to slam on the brakes. The steering wheel shakes my hands like an earthquake as we screech to a stop. Ay, Dios mío, she mutters, and then continues into an unintelligible string of desperate prayers. Juan starts to moan and her prayers get louder, more desperate. Is everyone okay? I ask. No, Alma cries between Juan's gasps. My shock gives way to more practical fears. Did I just kill someone? There's only one way to find out. I shift the car in reverse and turn around. Juan is drenched in sweat and wheezes after every breath. What are you doing? Alma yells at me as we barrel backwards down the road. We must go the other way. I ignore her and she works herself into a frenzy. He is dying, please, I beg to God. Please go the other way. I might have hit someone. So? They are already dead. My son is alive, she wails. Then I see it. A large black lump on the side of the road, bathed in the red of my taillights. I hit the brake. I don't want to hit it or them again. Stay here. I launch out of the patrol car and slam the door behind me. It's pure black outside, except for the lights on my running vehicle. I turn on my flashlight and rush to the animal lump on the road. Thank God I didn't hit a person. It's some kind of giant coyote, bigger than I've ever seen in the desert. The impact twisted his spine 180 degrees so his hind legs face one direction and his front legs face another. Exposed bone pops out of his shoulder, and blood covers his coat. But that's not the most horrible thing. My flashlight lands on his stomach, and I see a shallow breath. I guide the beam up to his face. The poor beast isn't dead. His glassy eye stares at the light. No, at me. And I don't see pain there. I see pure hate. I swear, he even snarls at me. Behind me, I hear Alma banging on the window. There's time for one final mercy I can give this animal. I take out my firearm and shoot him clean through the skull. The shot wakes up a dormant sense of duty in me, and I run back to the patrol car. Opening the trunk, Alma's shouting momentarily breaks the stillness of the desert. But there's something I need to do first. I grab a road flare, slam the trunk shut, and hustle back to the animal. He's so big that some unsuspecting driver could flip his car over the body. Popping the flare, I set it next to the coyote. Its red flame flickers in his dead eyes. Back in the car, I blast down the road with a new focus. How's your boy doing? I ask Alma. Really hot. We'll be at St. Mary's soon. It's a very good hospital. My mom is there. I look in the rearview mirror to see if my words bring Alma some comfort. What I find almost sends me off the road again. It's the wolf. He sits up on the road, a large black silhouette against the burning red flame. I turn back to the road and hit the gas. We crawl up to 110. Drunk Indians be damned. When we arrive at the emergency entrance to St. Mary's, two orderlies with a stretcher and a nurse were already waiting for us. They burst into action, lifting Juan's body onto the stretcher and rushing him inside. Alma and I follow close behind when suddenly Juan has a fit. He launches up and attempts to jump out of the stretcher. The orderlies try to push him down, but he bites one so deep that he staggers back. Juan nearly gets away when I hurry in to help. I hold his shoulders down on the stretcher while an older orderly gets his feet. With unnatural strength, Juan frees one of his arms from my grasp. I try to get him under control, but it's hard to get a grip on his sweaty skin. Even Alma races to grab his free arm, but he knocks her across the face. Then he claws his nails into my neck, and I shout bloody murder. Banishing the pain, I bear all my weight down his arm and slowly push it down to the stretcher until we're face to face. There's an animal hatred in his eyes, the same hate I saw in the wolf. Before Juan can free himself again, the other orderly runs back with a sedative. He hammers it into Juan's thigh, and I immediately feel him slacken. The orderlies and the nurse continue to push him into the ER. Alma chases after them, but the hospital security stops her. She knocks them back with almost as much tenacity as her son, and I have to grab her in a big bear hug. She resists at first, then breaks down into tears in my armpit. This sudden intimacy makes me feel uncomfortable. My professional instinct tells me to push away, but my humanity draws her closer. As I hold Alma, my gaze drifts above the entrance to the hallway. There's an icon of Mary cradling the baby Jesus, and I can't help but think of the crazy story she told me. It's just the dengue, right? Or could something worse have a hold of Juan? I reject the thought outright. All these insomnia-induced hallucinations have affected my judgment. My own guilty conscience has always been fodder for my nightmares. But Alma's story of satanic gangs, Maria's fitful death, and memories of Steve's human roadkill have pushed my demons out of my subconscious and into the waking world. Even now, as the nurse takes us into Juan's room, they walk among me. We go under those horrible buzzing hospital lights, and at one end of the hallway, the lights is broken. Beneath its flickering light, I see a patient I recognize. He's a young Indian with a black ponytail and a cool retro cowboy boots. He turns to us, and I see his torso is impossibly smashed. The black tread of a truck runs across it, and his intestines spill out at the bottom like a pop zit. We turn into the room before he can wave at me. Inside, Juan sleeps in a hospital bed with an IV attached to his arm. The sickly yellow color in his skin is gone, and his doctor tells us that his fever is under control. They've ruled out dengue. So what's wrong with him? Alma asks, still on edge. We're not 100% sure. Could be an infection, so we have him on antibiotics. We like to keep him under observation for the night, the doc turns to me without a look of disdain. I assume that's all right. Of course, I answer. Alma peppers in with questions until I interrupt. I'll be back soon. Don't go anywhere. She nods and I slip out. There's one more thing I have to do before sleep. I open the door to my mom's hospital room. She lies upright in bed, a mess of tubes and wires connected to her nose, vein, and finger. When lung cancer metastasized to her brain, They needed very aggressive treatment to get it under control. They warned me her brain function may have changed, whatever that means. Doctors love their euphemisms. They think it helps, but really it just makes you imagine the worst. I dread the moment my fears became reality, so I watch her for a while. On her bedstand, I recognize her large brass cross from home and her little icons of the Virgin de Guadalupe. I've never been a religious person like my mom, but I'm not gonna lie. That stuff on her table makes me feel something. I see how chemo has taken all of my mom's hair, and now she can barely breathe without that tube in her nose. In that moment, God exists for me. He exists enough to tell, for me to tell him, fuck you. Just then, my mom's eyes open. Santi, she says. Santiago, my father who died 20 years ago when I was 10. Nah, mom, it's me, Dominic. Of course, Dominic. She squints and then smiles at me. I'm not sure who she sees right now, but I don't think it matters. How are you doing? I ask. I'm okay, but you look horrible. Thanks, Mom, I laugh. Just a long day at work, I guess. Trouble at the shop? She asks me, and my heart sinks again. She must be talking about my dad. He worked as a mechanic. Really, Mom, it's okay, I'm fine. Tell me what's wrong, she insists. Listening to someone else's problems helps me forget about my own. Her smile gives way to a coughing fit, and I can't say no. She's a border person too now, like me and Alma, on the boundary of life and death, sense and nonsense. Who else can I talk about these things with? Okay, so I picked up this woman, and her son tried to cross the border the other day. The mom wants asylum because she's afraid gangs are going to kill her kid if they go back. And it's true, the kid's pretty shaken up. He's got these crazy bruises all over him and won't say a word. So, you must help them. I want to, but then the mom starts telling me this crazy story. She says a gang back in Mexico tries to sacrifice her kid to Satan. Like they tied him to the ground and chanted satanic prayers before they cut him open. Luckily, she came just in time to rescue him. I stopped mid-sentence. My mom's eyes are wide and her heart rate has jumped on her monitor. You okay, Mom? Yes, I'm fine. She puts her hand to her chest. Hey, don't let this story upset you. It's not a story. Yeah, I mean, I don't think she's lying intentionally. It's like PTSD or something. No, she insists and grabs my hand. You must believe her. You're scaring me, Ma. What's on your mind? You'll think I'm crazy. You already think I'm crazy. I don't think you're crazy. I fib because I don't want her to shut down her moment of lucidity. How many more mom moments does she have like this? I'm listening. Okay. It was before we moved, back when I was still a cop. She smiles and starts to tell me a story. I was responding to a 911 call about screams coming from an abandoned building. We knew the place well. Some gang had moved in there and turned it into a safe house. When I got there, I remember there was this horrible wind. You've never felt a wind like this. I was trying to get to the house, and it was blowing against me like it wanted me to stay away. The neighbors were outside yelling and wailing. There's someone inside, they kept shouting at me. So I couldn't call for backup. I had to go in for myself. Then this weird thing happens. I tried to open the door, and the wind changed direction. Now it was blowing the other way to keep the door shut. I had to put my foot against the frame to pry the door open, and I remember then it flew back with such an angry snap against the wall. I took my first step into the room, and the wind suddenly stopped. All of a sudden, this horrible smell hit me. The lights didn't work, so I ran over my flashlight around the room. There were gang signs tagged all over the walls. I had my gun out, but I was so scared that the beam was shaking. I had just gotten my own patrol, and I had forgotten the first rule of being a cop. Do you know what it is? No, I tell her. Always follow your nose. I looked down and I finally saw it. There was a kid, a Crip I think, 17 or 18, and he was cut all the way open from his chin down to his groin on a bed of cinder blocks. It's funny, but I don't remember screaming. I was too curious, I guess. I had never seen the inside of a man before. Then I felt something wet hit me on the head. I looked up with my flashlight and I could see the ceiling was dripping blood. They used his blood to draw a pentagram up there. You know what a pentagram is? Yeah, Mom, I know. It's the mark of a devil. But that's not why I believe the story you told me. Lots of gangs back then did stuff with the devil. This was different. How was it different? She shrinks at the memory. I found the knife they did it with. And when I tried to bag it into evidence, I heard a voice. It was whispering to me. Do you want to know what it said? A shiver goes down my spine. I'm not so sure lucidity was a good idea anymore. What did it say, Mom? My mom draws me close. She whispers something to me. Something I don't understand, but I've heard it before. It was on the radio in the desert, back when we found Juan. As she pulls away, I can feel my world go into a tailspin. A rapid beep, 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 beep brings me back to reality. It's my mom's heart monitor. She's spiking. Mom, you okay? She leans deeper in her pillows and looks up at the ceiling. He's here. He's here now, she says breathlessly. The beeping doesn't let up. Worried, I step out and I call a nurse. She grabs an attending physician and they kick me out of the room without saying more. There's nothing left for me to do but wait.
Oh, we're going to leave you on that cliffhanger.
Yeah.
That cliffhanger. Yeah, so this ended up seeming like it was going to be some racist border patrol, and ended up being some racist border patrol on Native Americans.
I just assumed
it was some drunk Native American walking down the street. That's incredibly racist.
Well, true races don't just stick to one race.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
I wrote down that, and then I wrote down, always follow your nose, which is also Toucan Sam's motto.
Yeah.
And his mom's motto.
Yeah. And the cop's motto, apparently.
Yeah, that's why it says, never mind. It's also Toucan Sam's motto. Okay?
Yeah.
Follow your nose wherever it goes, to the flavors of fruit, wherever they grow.
That's what they teach in the police academy first day. Follow your nose. That's where the blood smell is. It doesn't rhyme as well.
Yeah, but police, they're not.
So he's
all
getting
about
visited by all the bodies that they've ran across.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
and
so
Steve
that
is still a racist.
Yes.
Steve is definitely racist. And also, it's not looking good. You know, you want your son to get in the country and you're being such a problem. Mm. I mean, can he stop drawing pictures of demonic things for a second so we can get into the country? Jeez.
Well, now he's in the hospital, so I don't know if he's drawing much anymore.
Okay. Well, I'm drawing much right now. And I have shingles, you guys.
Yeah.
I talked about this earlier in the Facebook group. I just found out I have shingles. So I am doing this right now in an incredible amount of pain. So what a great time to check out the Facebook group.
Yes.
And look at these shingles that I have. And
when the shingles die down, we'll do another All Things Scary.
Oh, is that the reason we're not doing All Things? I thought the reason we're not doing All Things Scary is because Nick can't.
I was busy, man. I was gone Wednesday through Sunday.
Then don't blame it on my shingles that are ready to mingle. Shingles are ready to mingle. They want to come say hi, you want them to say bye. It's the shingles, they're ready to mingle.
Mm-hmm.
Shingles, they're ready to mingle. And what? Shingles are ready to mingle. You'll find them all around. You'll find them up and down because the shingles are ready to mingle.
You've been writing this song all day.
Yeah, this is a song I write about shingles. Anyway.
So come back next week for the conclusions.
Yeah, there's going to be more conclusions coming at you. This story.
Yep. Any shows you want to talk about?
Yeah, I have a lot of shows coming up. Nick and I are going to be in San Diego. We're going to be in Atlanta. I'm going to be in San Luis Obispo.
And we're also going to be in Portland. We are waiting for the exact venue for the person that keeps asking.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry. As soon as we get the info, we'll let you know.
Okay. And if you guys want to come to a show, that's the way you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else we got to talk about?
Follow us on everything.
Follow us on everything. I'm at Edie Gibson Comedy and Nick is at Nick Comic. And please give us a 5-star review because it really helps. And there are some haters out there that we'll read next week that are trying to hate on us and bring us down. But
we won't let them.
Ain't gonna work, Apple Pie Head.
Yeah.
Go join the Facebook group. And I think that's it.
Yep.
Uglies. We'll give you a immediate response on what's going on with these shingles because I know you're very worried about me.
Yep.
And we'll read the reviews next week.
And who's the one that figured it out?
Nick figured it out. He saw it and he knew.
I was like, oh, it's shingles. Everyone else is saying ringworm, psoriasis.
Yeah, but Nick knew immediately. He looked at it. He said, those shingles are ready to mingles.
Yep.
All right, so We'll see you next week, Uglies. Thank you so much for listening for another episode of True Scare Stories with Edie. And we'll see you later.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.